Mark McYoung is a self-defense expert. In fact, he's one of the OGs. He's written multiple books on the topic, and he's often called to serve as an expert witness for court proceedings that involve self-defense. In my first conversation with Mark, we discussed what you can expect if you ever have to plead self-defense for use of violence in a court. We discussed the important difference between being assertive and being aggressive when it comes to avoiding violence. And we discussed some of the social scripts that potential attackers will use to try and trick you or trap you. But the truth is, we barely scratched the surface. I find Mark one of the more interesting people to talk to, and there are still quite a few questions that were left unanswered. In this episode, we do a deep dive into process predators. Those are the people who will hurt you trying to gain resources, or worse, those are people who will hurt or kill you for their own amusement. Now, there are no pretty sides to violence, but this is certainly one of the ugliest ones. And if you're looking for nice, neat answers that all tie together and make you feel good in the end, you're not going to get any of that here. Mark tells it like it is, and he doesn't hold back. He certainly isn't always politically correct, but he's got a great sense of humor, which makes him fun to talk to. So I hope you enjoy this one. Evil thrives when good men and women do nothing, when they fail to make a stand. This podcast is about giving you the tools and the information to make that stand. I'm Ron Engelman, Master Sergeant, Krav Maga Black Belt, IDF combat veteran, proud Jew, and grandson to Holocaust survivors. This is the Ron Engelman Podcast. I'm going to hit the ground running. Let's pick up exactly where we left off. We spoke about five indicators of a process predator. What is a process predator? Let's start with that, and then maybe we can get into the indicators.
Okay. We're going to go back to Roy Miller's model of social and asocial violence, right? Which is a really, really useful tool. It's a wonderful way to understand the complexities of violence. Now, social violence, there's all these different ways that it happens and for all these different purposes. But most of them have to do with social, either gaining or maintaining your status. Okay? Rule enforcement, all these different things. Fascinating subject all by itself. Asocial violence tends to come in one of two ways. Now, understand that these types of violence and their goals and their rules and how they come about are totally different. So that's why you have to, you know, make this distinction. One type of violence is resource, or one type of asocial violence is resource. Now, Rory originally came out with resource predation, which is very true. It's a very real thing. But equally common, or not as common, but equally valid, is resource protection. Okay. And basically, you either fighting to gain or you're fighting to protect resources. Now, I have a really good example to show you the mindset difference here. Hold out your hand, or hold out your arm, actually. Okay. Now, look at your arm. Look at your arm.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. There's a mosquito on it biting you. What do you do? There's a mosquito on your arm biting you.
You slap it.
Right. You kill it. Okay. Did you even think about that?
Nope.
Did you try and dominate and establish status? Yo, mosquito, you best be stop biting me. I'm going to mess you up. No?
No.
Nothing, right? Just you flat out kill it. Okay. That was you protecting your resources. You are a resource. Okay. And the mindset of that type of violence is way different than social violence. Now, the other difference is that this is very common with robberies. So when you're dealing with a robber, you tend to be dealing with resource asocial violence. Okay. Got a very clear goal. Okay. Now, all of these other things, it's very important to understand that the goal is something other than violence. Violence is a means to that goal.
100%.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you can understand that very clear distinction. Now, here's the other thing, we'll get into this in a second. Most violence comes with instructions how to avoid it.
I love that.
They will tell you. Yeah, that was really cool to, you know, I get so much for Rory and then be able to give that to him. And it was like, I never thought about it. Yeah, it's true. They'll tell you how to avoid violence. Okay. Knowing that is important to understand that with a process predator, the goal is violence.
Okay.
This is the monster that we fear, that he gets off on the violence.
Okay.
It is a rush.
Maybe from my understanding, so we've got the asocial violence, which is it's instrumental, right? I want to get your wallet. Let's not even step into sexual assault, because that can take many contexts. But let's stick with the robbers. That, you know, they want something from you. The violence is not necessary. It could even be it could either be a benefit. It could be a disadvantage. But that's not the point. They want the wallet. You've got your status seeking aggression. That's what we called it with my chat with Bill von Hippel, the social psychologist, which is, the purpose is, I want to show everybody that I'm the top dog. I want to dominate you. It's a type of social violence. What it sounds to me like, you're talking about the process predator. Correct me if I'm wrong. We're going more towards the serial killer, the person who enjoys, let's say, the act itself.
Yes. Now, I have a very controversial point that I make, and it's one of those things that when I say this, the feminists want to lynch me. Okay. And that is, you mentioned rape. A large percentage, you got the serial rapist, who that is his goal. He loves it. He gets off on it. Okay. But also, a large amount of rape is a form of educational beatdown. So it does have a, you know, a social game on it.
But look, if we look at it, let's say, in the prison context, let's say, it's a way to domineer, to completely destroy the other person, to dominate them, to take their soul. Yes. It's very much a way. And certainly, you know, like I said, the sexual assault can take so many different, the hardest one to crack, because you can't just put something on it. It seems to be the least, while it's a sexual act, it seems to be that the, and again, it's very hard to kind of put the sexual gratification is not the main,
it's not necessarily the main purpose.
And again, this can change, right? This, like, I mean, again, there's so many, unfortunately, there's so many different kinds of sexual assault. That's why it's really hard. And I didn't necessarily want to go down that path yet. It's certainly something worth discussing. Go ahead.
Okay. Something else that, Rory and I have a slight disagreement on the system. Okay. And it comes from our backgrounds. Okay. In the correctional environment he grew up, he very, very, very clearly saw the difference between social and asocial violence. I mean, in a distilled, right. And he talked about it.
You're referring to his prison experience. Yes.
Yeah, right. Well, let's clarify that. Being a county jail guard, or working in the county jail. Yes. Right. He got to see these animals in a zoo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And wow, lots to be learned from them. But he tended to go that it was one or the other. Okay. I approach the subject as you get more of a mix, right? More, you can get either one purely, but often you'll get a weird mix because they haven't decided which way they're going to go yet. Mm-hmm. So when you're dealing with a situation, you got to look at it and go, okay, how much of it is this versus how much is this? Now, he talks about how it can switch, which is true. Okay. But I've encountered enough stuff out in the street that I call them at the larval stage, where they can't decide which way they're going to go.
Yep.
So they get this weird mix. And understanding it, that they develop into process predators.
Okay. So let's get that distinction. So the process predator. So we've separated the resource predator, right? They're the person who wants to rob you. Okay. We've separated the social predator, let's say, the one that wants to dominate you, to show everybody. Again, even in that sense, the violence, you could say that the violence is the purpose, but you could also say that the violence is the mechanism in which they establish dominance.
Yes.
You're talking about is it's a either a third category, or more correctly, a category that exists within the social, which is somebody who uses violence as a form, we could say entertainment, but so it's
soothing, entertainment, gratification,
mm-hmm,
all
gratification.
Of it.
I think that's more accurate model. Okay.
And
I think now I've got a grasp. Okay, so how to separate? So the process predator is your serial. It doesn't have to be also serial killer. I've seen process predators. I've seen people who their idea of a good night out is having a few drinks and grabbing some poor fool in the bar and, you know, smashing their teeth out just for fun. That is a process predator.
Yes, exactly. Now, one of the other key points here is when you have these other types of violence here, if the goal is achieved, violence doesn't happen. Okay. One of the things about resource predation, you can understand it very simply, is it's over something you can put in a wheelbarrow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I can take your wallet, drop it into a wheelbarrow. Okay. It's got something hard. It's got something solid that has a physical existence. Social status is a little more murky, but all of these things, if achieved, that's the, you know, that's avoiding they'll avoid violence. Okay. The process predator, the goal is the violence.
Okay.
So whether it's beating you, killing you, torturing you, humiliating, that's what they're working for.
So it's critical in identifying the process predator because they're a complete different animal. And, you know, we spoke about the humanization tactics of saying, oh, please don't hurt me. I've got a wife and kids. Okay, that might help on the social. It won't really help you with the resource predator. And it might just egg on. It might just get the process predator more enthusiastic. So you need to know who's in front of you so that you know your strategy. Are you trying to de-escalate here? Or should you?
Yes.
Okay, so what should you be doing before we identify it? So once I'm with a social predator, is it straight away fight? You know,
bring your
hands up?
No. Okay. We talked about the ways to recognize when you're dealing with a process predator.
Actually, we haven't. Let's go into that now. The five indicators.
There's kind of a prerequisite bit of information.
Let's do it.
Okay. And that is, process predators tend to hide behind social scripts.
Hmm.
So they're going to be messing with you, and they'll be, like I said, they like to play with their food. Okay. They get off on your fear, your terror, and you desperately trying to find a social script that'll work against them. Okay. That's an important thing to know. Because when the person's like, please, I have a wife and kid, right? For them, that's like, I get to play with this one. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is, and when I talk about recognizing, it will look like a social situation. It may even be over social circumstances. Okay, but now you have to separate the wheat from the chaff and figure out that's not what's going on. Okay, so one of the first rules, there's five things you can look for dealing with a process predator. And there's caveats and all this, you know. Number one, he breaks the script. Okay, that is a big, big indicator. Now, tell me how a robbery happens. Give me the story of a robbery.
There's so many, so they're different sorts from an ambush sort of an attack where, you turn the wrong street or they've been following you and they ambush you to, you just stumble into the wrong place and the wrong time. And it's more of an opportunity that they're over there to what we discussed last time. It could be something hidden in social scripts that kind of escalates into a robbery. First they ask you for some change, and then they say, yeah, that's not enough. And then they can play in the circle, right? They can see how far they can rob you without stepping out of the circle. And I've seen people do that. You get robbed and you don't feel or know that you're getting robbed, but your mind is your wallet and your phone.
You've actually identified one of the other steps of how to recognize a process predator. But what I was asking is, give me a breakdown of the script of being robbed. Now, one of the bizarre things, and you can really help your readers, and it's just a sidebar. We can come back to it later if you want. Social violence has a script. It has a certain way it builds and escalates and de-escalates, right? There's certain actions you do, and then, if you don't do this, it can lower it down, or if you do that, it can escalate it up. A robbery, typical, the guy approaches you with some pretext of normal. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, when you understand social violence is blessed, attack, right? Instructions how to avoid attack. What was weird about a resource robbery is he'll come walking up to you, pretending it's normal. He will actually start the attack. He will go from like, hey, where's Main Street, to pointing a gun at you. He started the attack. He's initiated the attack. And then he stops.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the instructions how to avoid violence come in. So it's SWAT.
Yeah, I like to say that if we jump back into the dojo, the training room for a second, I say when somebody puts a gun to your face, when somebody puts a knife in front of you, what are they? So they're trying to intimidate you, right? If they wanted to shoot you, they would have shot you. So what do they want? What do they want from you? And people say, they want my wallet, they want whatever, and I say they want your cooperation. They want your cooperation. They're intimidating you for cooperation. They could shoot you and then take your wallet out of your pocket. They want you to cooperate in giving you your valuables. So generally a robber, when somebody puts something in your face, is they want you to cooperate. And then you need to stop and you need to say, okay, am I willing to cooperate with this request? You want my wallet? Sure. You want me to get into your car?
Yes.
Okay, that's where I draw the line, and now I'm going to fight.
That's different. You're absolutely right about that, cooperation. It's like, give me what I want and I won't hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very, very true. After you give him what you want, what's the script?
They should be walking away.
Right, or they tell you to get out of there. So you've actually, again, this is something you know already. but you've never consciously thought about it in these terms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So he approaches, he gives you, he attacks, he gives you instructions how to avoid. Once he get what he wants, he stops and leaves. Okay. That's a script. Okay. If you know how to follow that script, you can actually keep from getting hurt most times. Okay. Does that make sense from the idea of a script of robbery?
Yep. 100%.
You can take that into the social world as well. And, you know, you get these scripts. One of the things to really watch for is process predators break the scripts.
Mm. So they're hiding in the script. It could be process predator could be hiding in the script of a robbery.
Yes, they could hiding.
They could be hiding in the script of a bar fight. They could be hiding, you know, in different places in those scripts. I got you.
Can I change one word that you said?
Please.
It's not could. It's are.
Mm.
Okay. They're hiding in the script while they're building or working up to an attack. And it could be working up, like getting, pumping themselves up or setting up. They're hiding within.
Or could it also be they're conducting the interview process? They're trying to establish how appropriate of a victim are you going to be.
See if they can get away with it. Yeah. But, you know, you talked about earlier, you mentioned like de-escalating things, right? When you're trying to de-escalate something, and I mean, this is, okay, this is assuming you haven't just stepped on your dick prior. Okay. Now, if somebody says, you know, and I mean, if you really were looking at somebody, you know, and somebody says, what are you looking at? It's like, hey, I'm sorry. You know, I was just thinking about something. I didn't mean any offense. Right. I've offered an apology. Right. Now, in a social script, what's the correct thing to do?
That's a challenge. Okay. That's a challenging one, but I'm going to go with you and I'm going to say, okay, fuck off. You know, don't do it again.
Exactly.
Supposedly. I say that reservedly, that specific example. If somebody goes, what are you looking at? They're usually trying to instigate something. It's not that it's right. Not necessarily that you've caused offense. They've been looking for a reason to take offense and to come over here. But let's not dwell into the.
No. You're right on that. And that knowing that is critical, because when, you know, if you have unintentionally given offense, a sincere apology is a legitimate, you know, response that should lower tension.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the script for handling and lowering tension. Now, you're right. In a lot of cases, the guy says, what are you looking at? He's looking for an excuse to go off.
Yep.
It's not a real, you know, it's not real, but he's hiding behind a social script. He's looking, in that case, he's looking for an excuse to go off.
Okay. I like that. I'm with you.
Okay. So, but here's the thing. You throw it out. It's the apology. It's not like, oh, an apology never works with these guys. No, this is a test. Okay, this guy's got, you know, he's got umbrage over something I did. I don't think I did it. But you know what? Hey, I have no problem apologizing. And sincerely, like, hey, I meant no offense. I'm terribly sorry if I upset you. Now, I will give the guy a chance to go, yeah, well, don't be messing with me. Okay, fine, whatever. As long as you do it over there, we're cool. That is within the script. It's when the guy breaks the script that tells me something ain't right here. Okay. I don't know if this is, you know, but that warning, that's an early warning for me to mentally shift gears. Okay. It's like I make a sincere apology and he breaks the script and doesn't follow it beyond normal variations. And that is a good indicator that I'm dealing with a process predator. Okay, so.
But what if my politeness doesn't work?
Right? Hey, you know, if you think of it as a test, like, let me throw this out to see if that works. Huh. Now I know. Now I got a better idea what I'm dealing with.
Yep.
Okay. So step one is he breaks the script. Another serious danger sign of a process predator is he'll try and take you to get you to go to a secondary location.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The robbery. Give me your money. I got your money. I'm gone. You're gone. You know, we're done. You're just an ATM with legs. Okay. You mean nothing to me. Why would he want me to go to a secondary location?
The secondary location is always going to be a place that's going to be better for them and worse for you. It's going to make it safer for them to carry out whatever they want to carry out with you, and it's going to make it harder for you to resist. And they've already established that your best interest is not what they're after right here.
Exactly. And I've seen experts debate this subject, whether being taken to a secondary location is bad 95% of the time, 96 up to 98. I mean, these guys seriously squabble over the exact percentage of trouble that happens in secondary location. And I'm like, you know what? Past 90% of the time, it doesn't matter. It's bad. Don't do it.
100%. That's a red line. I say the moment, like, if a fight's going to break out, let it be here where there are people. Let it be here where I can maybe get away. Let's not do this. Let's not wait for you to pull out your knife when we're in a dark alley or when we're inside a car.
Did we or did we not discuss using the word fight?
Because this is a fight. I'm with you. It's assault. It's assault. It's not a fight.
I'm going to play show and tell with this guy has just told me I'm going to probably have to play show and tell with his vital organs.
Mm-hmm.
If this goes physical, this ain't a fight. I'm going to neutralize him with great prejudice.
Yep. Okay. I like that. That's why more and more so, sometimes you'll catch me, but more and more so, I refer to what we do in self-defense as assault. And we discussed this on the last podcast. I don't think that the law has a term for fighting. Fighting is not. No, you assaulted me, and I assaulted you back.
No, I mean, this guy means to do me a great level of harm, and I'm going to break him. So to keep him from, if it goes physical, my goal is not to fight him. It's to snap him in half and neutralize him.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. And the thing is, when he calls for me to go to a secondary location, he just told me, this isn't following script, that this is what I'm dealing with.
Okay. I got you. So number one, we've got breaking of the scripts. Number two, we've got the attempt to move to secondary location.
Secondary location. Number three is he demands you do something that will reduce your ability to resist.
Like?
Get in the trunk of the car. Let me tie you up. Get on your knees.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Those are pretty obvious. What about less obvious ones?
Really subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But very, very. Teja von Winkle pointed something out that I really liked. Where he was talking, or she was talking about how a process predator will get a woman to cooperate.
Mm.
And that is, he walks up and hits her harder than she has ever been hit in her life. Okay. I mean, women don't understand how rare it is for a man to hit a woman as hard as he hits another man.
I think a lot of men have never been hit outside of the martial arts. I think the majority of men have never been hit full force in the head with a good roundhouse kick.
Oh, you know, the first time you get this and it's like, whoa, he's serious. Yes, you're absolutely right. But here's a woman who has always been, she's grown accustomed to being respected, not physically assaulted, not dealing with pain, right? On that such an, I mean, on any level, much less that intense of a level.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this guy hauls off and drills her, right? And as she's laying there, you know, he, you know, he'll kneel down and say, look, I'm sorry that I had, you know, that I hit you. I mean, I don't want to hurt you. You know, if you only cooperate me, I won't have to hurt you again.
Mm. That's really, okay. Really serial, really going down serial killer lane. I hear you.
We're not driving. We are speeding down serial killer, serial rapist lane.
Okay. If I can interject here, actually, I've got something I was discussing. So you're familiar with, I think it's Robert Cialdini. He's the psychologist who literally wrote the book on influence, right?
Gotcha.
Right. So his research is a textbook for anybody who's in sales and has been, like, he literally wrote the book on it many, many years ago. I think his research back in the 70s. And so he doesn't go from there. He goes, how to get people to do what you want. And that's, you know, generally what salespeople do. And there's the sales technique of, like, getting the yeses. It's also very old school sales, right?
They'll
come to the door and they say, you know, can I get a glass of water? And like, okay, what's the harm? Right. I don't want to buy your vacuum cleaner, but sure, I'll get you a glass of water. Right. It's really hot. Right. You mind if I come in a second? Okay, look, right. I just want to show you this brochure, right? So they're getting the yes and the yes and the yes, and they're creating this pattern. And you're already going down that lane so far that by the time you have to put up resistance, it's that much harder. I've also heard it put into the context of self-defense in terms of, I think Tim Larkin and I were speaking about this, in terms of a strategy where my instincts and everything saying, look, I've complied, and so far this strategy has kept me safe, and I'm invested in that strategy. So now when things, I think it's easy to come out and say, if some, you know, some mugger comes out with a ski mask out of the bushes, puts a knife to me and says, get in the car, I'm going to go, no, secondary location, I'm going to fight, I'm going to assault you right here. I think that's obvious, but I think reality is a little bit more complex than that. And it's something that gradually happens. Maybe it's somebody that you met in a bar. Maybe, you know, maybe they've got some friends with them. Maybe at initially it was right to comply. Maybe it started with, you know, get out of my seat. Like you said, I love this. You know, in the scripts, it started in the scripts. And in the scripts, it seemed like a good idea to comply. But you're complying. And now when they say, again, I mean, this stuff works. That's how people sell vacuum cleaners, and they sell... they get you on, you know, on a payment plan for cable TV or whatnot. These things work on humans, so it would be silly to think that it's not going to work on you, especially in extreme cases of violence, unless you're trained to see it and you've spent some time thinking about it. And I see you grinning here.
You're right. Let me also point something out. I have been sitting here smiling when you're talking about this, because you're explaining something that is so true. People do not know it.
Mm.
Okay. But it's, they have a blind side. Now, did you know that there is a name for what you just described so well? It's called a yes set.
Mm.
And it is a strategy that you get them agreeing until you get to what the point that you want. And by that time, it's too hard. But yes, the term yes set is exactly what you're talking about.
Okay, so can we put that in into the model? Just because, you know, we love to, you know, we just said that reality is complex and doesn't fit into our clear-cut categories. But to make sense of things, we love to put things in categories. So let's put that in the yes set as another tool that makes resistance more difficult. A psychological tool, not a physical tool. Yeah.
Now, here's, you actually hit many of the key points of why this strategy works. She's had a negative result. She has stable data that this guy can do stuff to her that hurts, she can't handle. Okay. And he's giving her this little window of opportunity to use social skills, which she is more comfortable with, which she does have power doing. She is accustomed to having power, you know, this kind of power. And he's giving her an opportunity. Okay, if I play it right, I can get him, I can manipulate him to my side. Okay, the further down that rabbit hole you go, the less able you are to physically do what you need to do to stop this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
by sending you down this rabbit hole or this, you know, this path, he's actually reduced your ability to resist.
So let's put in here another good word for the benefit of training in full force martial arts, where we condition yes. ourselves to violence, whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, that if you're used in a safe setting to getting hit as part of sparring, when you get hit for the first time for real, it's something that it's not going to put you into complete panic mode, and you can still, I mean, what's sparring about? Sparring is about getting, what's the number one benefit of sparring? It's about getting hit really hard and still being able to execute some sort of game plan.
Right. Now, okay, the reason I was laughing, first of all, yes, you do have to need to know how to take a hit and keep functioning. All right, that doesn't have to be your everyday standard of training, because that is actually abusive and not really useful.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? Bam, I got pegged. Okay, so what? Right, it's not the end of the world. Okay. That is very, very true. And full contact does have to be a part of training. Okay. The reason I started cracking up is when you are better at a certain level, you really can't help but hit hard. Even when you're going slow or light, there's still going to be enough energy transference. Well, I had a friend who was such a person. I mean, this guy would hit you so hard, you'd get a speeding ticket in Malta. Okay. But, you know, he's just working out at the seminar. And this guy, you know, reels back and says, "You're hitting too hard." And without thinking, he goes, "I hit my wife harder during sex." And I'm like, you know, that's not how you deliver this message. But damn, that's funny. So, yeah, you do need to know that you can survive getting hit. And I mean, that's part of boxing is very good. After, you know, oh, I'm scared of getting hit. I'm scared of getting hit. After a while, boxing is like, so what? It's not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But for somebody who doesn't have that experience, getting hit that hard, that just rocks their world, right? And they don't, they've suddenly been introduced to a reality that they did not believe existed. Okay, when we were filming my video, Street Safe, there was a scene where the background is I was talking to, we're filming, and I was talking with the director, and, you know, they came up and said, "Okay, what do you want with this shot?" And I said, "Okay, I want you to, as you chase her to the car, I want you to grab her, drag her over that low wall as if you're going to take her over." Right. And it's like, okay, gotcha. So I'm talking, you know, go back to talking to the director, and I'm hearing, And then I hear a yeep. Right? And we both look up and I see her legs going over the wall. Right? Now, the guy who was doing, big boy, Scott, was a semi-pro football player until he blew his knees out.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked up and said, what was that? And he goes, I did what you told me to. And I was like, no, I told you to drag her over to the wall as if you were going to take her over. He's like, oh, I didn't hear that. And I was like, yeah, well, now we got to do it again. Right? We've established the shot. So next three shots, he took her over the wall. Right? Thing about it is, he was very good about it. And I mean, he landed with her on top. So he acted as a cushion. So it really hurt him to do this. But later I was talking to Catherine, the woman, and she was like, and I said, what? She goes, I'm a big girl. And he just picked me up like I was nothing. And I was like, yeah, that's male upper body strength. You know, that's what it feels like. That's, you know, reality. But, you know, again, in this subtle form of, you know, reducing your ability to exist or to resist, he's hurt her, stunned her, and then given her an option that is going to make her passive, trying to find a social way out of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a trap. Okay. Instead of gouging his eyeball out, she's going to try and talk her way out of something worse. So, yeah, break script. What is it? Break script. God, we did this in a slightly different order. Break script, secondary location, reducing your ability. Okay. The other thing is the fourth sign is he continues and escalates. Okay. This is the guy that says, you know, what are you looking at? You apologize. And instead of taking, and he breaks the script, but then he goes, yeah, I think you're disrespecting me. Right. He accuses you of doing something else. Right. And no matter how hard you try to apologize or, you know, find a script friendly way out of the situation, it keeps on going. This is like the robber walks up and says, give me your wallet. Now give me your watch. Okay. And he should be gone by now. But he's continuing it. And his demands keep on getting more and more. Okay. That is when something goes on longer than it should. Okay. Where this guy starts going off, and often these escalations are like, often the hell did that come from? Okay. That, I mean, I used to call this tantrum violence, which is, hey man, give me a cigarette. Give me a cool. Give me a cool menthol, right? Where the escalations get more and more outrageous until you can't meet them anymore. And then the person attacks.
Yep.
Okay. So yeah, the continuing and escalating is the fourth step. The fifth step is very, very specific. And it comes back to these guys playing with their food. Okay. You should, and that is humiliation.
Mm.
And I mean, hardcore humiliation, getting you to grovel. You should never have to suck somebody's dick to keep from getting beaten. Right. And they'll do this because they're playing with their food.
Yep.
You know, yeah, you don't want me to shoot you. Get on your knees and bark like a dog. Right. I mean, it is hardcore humiliation. I'm not talking about like, well, he offended me by robbing me. Right. I mean, this is degradation. Yeah, I do speak English. And those are the five signs that once you see this, right, once you see this behavior veering, that's time to flip the switch of this is not a social situation. This is not even resource predation. This is about something else. And that goal is violence.
Okay.
And so, a level of violence that is horrible.
Yeah. 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 Because, yeah, it's not just going, it's not, the violence is not going to stop in order to, you know, get your belongings or to show or just to get dominance over you. It's going to stop when they've met their gratification, and God knows where that's going to be, where that's going to end you up.
Yeah, the guy is already off the rails. Okay, so where it's going to stop, you know, it's funny. I have a thing where people talk to me about something bad, and, you know, my question is, did the person live? And they go, yeah. I said, good, we can work with that. And it's like, no, you don't understand the trauma. This is horrible. This is the worst thing that could possibly happen. And they never ask me the question that I ask if the answer is no, which is, how many parts was his body found in?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I mean, that's a level of horror that they don't understand. They don't even believe it exists. Right. Okay. So, but with dealing with process predators, that's an important question, because that kind of tells you how far down the road this guy is.
Yeah. And it's certainly not something that I want to find out, because it's something completely out of my control. And out of all the violence, that's the one that goes the farthest. So I've identified a process predator. As far as I understand it, I have exactly two options. The first one is intimidation, and the second one is violence.
Third option is, no, I'm going to go find an easier target.
Which is what intimidation accomplishes. I might not be able to beat you, but I can certainly make it costly enough, or make it appear that it's going to be costly enough for you to choose me as a victim. And that comes to early identification and stopping it earlier. So we were discussing about, I've heard, we're familiar with the interview process, right? When somebody kind of is sussing you out, they follow you, they look at you, they maybe approach you within the scripts to see if you're suitable. I've heard it described differently for the same thing. It's kind of like a vampire, that they're sucking your energies out. And they, every step that they go further down the line, you feel weaker and they feel more powerful. So so if we understand that through this, that they're sucking every step of the way, every step of the interaction, they're sucking away your power. So the moment you've identified that this is not, you know, your social strategies are not going to work here, your humanization tactics of being polite is not getting you anywhere. And that, and we've just, I think what we discussed established it pretty well. You say, look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to create offense. And they say, well, you have, now, you know, give me your hat or something. Like, you know, that this is going somewhere bad, just like the things that we discussed. So here, this is the point where I need to start breaking the scripts. This is the point where, you know, normally if you come in the bar, we say that's the classical status seeking violence, where, you know, I want to show everybody that I dominate you. Generally, the right answer there is not saying, you want to fight? Well, I know how to fight too. I've got a black belt in Hu Flung Dung or whatever. And, you know, I'm a tough guy. No.
Yeah.
But once you've, like, that'll take you down a fight. We spoke about the difference between being assertive and not being aggressive last time.
Aggressive,
so with the social violence, the guy who wants to show everybody, the tough guy, I want to be assertive, but not aggressive. When I've identified a process predator, being aggressive is fine. Again, if I'm willing to take that there, politeness is not going to get me there. I don't want to maybe, this is a tricky one, right? Because we want to put on, again, we want to put on rules that are going to apply to every situation. And reality simply isn't so. And it could be, like you said, it could be they say somebody, somebody says, whatever, here, get into the car. And you say, and you're not polite about it. You say, fuck off, and boom, you get hit, right? You can be assertive with still maintaining a level of politeness. Again, it's a complex one, but it's certainly yes, being violent is always there, is always an option, but we want to try to solve this without it going to violence, not because we have any problem morally of using violence here, but the assumption is that if they've chosen you, they've got some edge over you physically. Maybe they've got a weapon, maybe they're bigger than you, maybe they've got some friends with them, maybe all of the above. So what's left for me is to be able to communicate.
You've done really good. Everything you've said is very accurate. I'm interrupting you for a very specific reason at this point.
Go ahead.
The main thing these guys have is their willingness. I mean, let's say this is social violence. Their major advantage is the level of violence they're willing to do is up here. I mean, they just go from 0 to 60. Boom. Okay. If you do the typical workup that most people do, they've got you because they're here already. They're ready for that.
Mm.
Okay. They mean to do you this level. And if they're drawing it out, it's for fun and games. Okay. You talked about, the aggression, fuck you, That is a problem because that is this. That shows you're here. They're here. And you start doing that, they know you're here, not up there. Now, I, for years, had a thing, and COVID got in the way of the last 2 years, but it was called the Animalist Barbecue, where I would bring martial artists and violence professionals from around the world. Well, I got Rory Miller and Peyton Quinn in my yard. Okay. And they're going on, and Peyton is talking about the his five rules of violence. Okay. Don't insult him, don't challenge him, don't threaten him, don't deny it's happening. Give them a face-saving exit. Okay. All of these are things that people will screw up with violence, but especially with social violence. Well, Rory came up to me and he said, look, my problem with that is that works with social violence. And I went, absolutely. And he goes, but it doesn't work, that works to de-escalate social violence. It doesn't work with asocial violence. Okay. And this was when we had one of our famous disagreements. First of all, social violence can be de-escalated. Asocial violence has to be deterred.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I like that. I like that very much.
Yeah, it's a very important distinction. Now, you can sometimes avoid social violence by being a bigger chest thumper. Okay. Not usually that good of a strategy, but it works a lot of the time. It's one of those weird. Yeah.
I've got one. Okay. So one of my best friends, we in Sydney, he's an Israeli dude, but also he was living in Sydney at the time, and we live in Bondi Beach. We'd be surfing over there. And He was an okay surfer. He had this massive, massive board. And Bondi Beach gets crowded in the surf. And if you think road rage is something, on crowded beaches, surf rage, wow.
Oh, yeah. That's, oh, yeah, yeah. Especially if some guy's got a log that, you know.
That's a real thing. And he surfed this. He's exactly. And he surfed this thing. He didn't give a fuck. It was a long board, a lot of speed. He'd sit way, way behind the waves, and he just start paddling. It was like a truck. The moment it started moving, it's not getting out of the way. If you were in the way, he'd run you over. Yeah. If you thought, and he'd piss off a lot of people, especially, you know, a foreigner surfing a big, and he was that kind of guy also. He didn't get, he wasn't especially big, but he was. He actually served military police undercover in the IDF back in his time during the Second Intifada and before. So he'd seen his share of tough violence. Like, I mean, the streets over there are tough. So he certainly wasn't deterred about violence. He wasn't a great fighter, but he's certainly conditioned to violence. And his go was this. It would happen, you know, at least a couple of times a week. He'd piss off somebody by almost running them over with the board, and those things can do some serious damage. And he wasn't he certainly wasn't always in the right. And somebody would come up and you son of a bitch, and he'd the moment it started, he'd paddle full force straight up to them, because it's easy to shout at somebody who's in their car and you're in their car. So
close,
he'd swim straight up close, look them up in the face, and he goes, "Do you want to punch or do you want to shake? Okay, choice is yours. Let's go."
Oh, let's go. Yeah.
So that
kind of force people don't want to play at.
That came to mind when you said that, you know, they're escalating and you're down there trying to de-escalate. And what he was doing was they were escalating and he's going, "I'll take it one step further. Like, you know, you want to talk? Let's go. I'll take it to the ultimate. Either you meet me, or I'm giving you face-saving exit. Let's shake hands and let's be friends." Now, it's important to understand that that works 9 times out of 10. He got into a few fights. He avoided a lot of fights, but he also got into a few fights too.
Yeah. Well, okay. Showing you're not afraid is a very important thing, but it's showing that you're really not afraid rather than just going.
No, okay. Like if you want to take it there, then you better be willing to go there. Right. It can't be an empty threat. If you're going to threaten in the army, in the Australian army, they have this thing where, like, anywhere, it's good practice. You don't pull out your gun unless you're willing to shoot. You don't pull out your gun to intimidate somebody. Otherwise, it's going to be taken away from you and it's going to be used against you. So if you take out your gun, you better be used. Same thing. If you put out the threat of violence, you better be ready to deliver. Otherwise, it's going to backfire.
And most people do threat displays to avoid having to use violence. And the bad guys know it. It's like this guy. There's a movie, Jeremiah Johnson, where two trappers come up, a bunch of Indians, and they've run into some others, and they've, you know, those Indians ended up dead. They ended up with that equipment, right? Or with those horses. And they encounter a different type of Indian. And the guy's like, "Yada, yada, 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 yada." And Jeremiah Johnson goes, "Why is he yelling?" And this old trapper goes, "He's scared of you."
Hmm.
Right? See, so you think you're doing this big, see how fierce I am? Right? And these level monsters know you're bluffing. You're scared of them.
Yep.
Okay. So, you know, when Rory said Peyton's 5 rules don't apply to asocial violence, my response was, "Oh, yes, they do." Okay. Because they won't deter, they won't de-escalate it or deter it. But what they'll do is you'll insult the dude and they'll escalate it. So don't. And I mean, that's what will turn a robbery into a shooting. Have you ever heard of Nicole Dufresne?
No, I have not.
This is an object lesson of what not to do when you're getting mugged. I've spoken with people who actually knew her. Right. And she was very competent. She was a struggling actress in New York City, and she was working her way up. She was, you know, okay person, all these. One night she went out with a bunch of friends, and they encountered a group of muggers. Well, this one guy pulled a pistol, walked up, pistol whipped her boyfriend, knocked this guy down to the ground, waving the gun. He goes, "Give us your money," et cetera, et cetera. Well, she's kneeling next to her boyfriend or fiance, I don't remember which. And she looked up and they hadn't gone yet. Okay. And her last words were, you've gotten what you wanted. Why don't you leave? What are you going to do now? Shoot us?" Yeah, actually, that's what he did. He killed her. Okay. I mean, that was a challenge. She took it. She tried to get some face saving, you know, control back in her life against a resource predator. And in doing so, she insulted him. She challenged him. She disrespected him in front of his friends. He had to shoot her. To that mindset, he had to shoot her. Okay. So when you're dealing with process predator, you'll want to, okay, you'll want to come across aggressive, because that is a social script for avoiding violence. And in doing so, you can insult him, challenge him, and threaten him. Okay. Or I actually added one to Peyton's five. So I call it Peyton's 5+1, which is do not imperiously command. And that's especially true for women. Go away. No. You're not the Red Queen giving orders. But, you know, again, that can actually trigger a negative reaction with asocial violence and make it go worse. Mm-hmm. So what I'm talking about, recognizing that you're dealing with an asocial process predator. Okay. It's like, zip, you have to go to that level too. Now, did you ever see the movie Tombstone?
Yes.
Val Kilmer, OK Corral, who else? Kurt Russell?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember the scene where the gunfight, everybody's like, "Give up your guns," and everybody grabs their guns and is like, because nobody wanted to play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very tense moment. Then Doc Holliday goes, "Thanks, pal." Although they actually do believe that what kicked it off was Doc Holliday did click the hammers on the shotgun. And everybody, you know, the faster way to shoot was you draw your gun, cock it, and shoot, right? More accurate. So everybody who heard that thought somebody else had done it. Okay. Somebody else had started it. But that's just a bit of trivia. Dealing with a process predator, instead of threatening, trying to bless him or try and scare him, if your mindset is, "I am a heartbeat away from combat here. Okay. And if this kicks off, we're both going to die." Right. And that's okay. But if this kicks off, I am going to hit this guy with such a level of force, which, by the way, if you have your training, odds are you're going to be more competent at violence than him. Okay. Now you have two players at this level. And the question really does come down to who spent more time getting better at this level. See? So threats, bluster, looking tough, out the window. Okay. The attitude of "I'm going into combat," right? And I have to be ready for that level of violence. I mean, have you ever been shot at?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Were you surrounded by fellow soldiers?
Yes.
Okay. Going out into a patrol where you could get ambushed, going into a firefight that you know it's coming, were you swaggering?
No, not always. Sometimes it's, you know, it's no. Generally, when it catches you, even when it's an operation, right? An operation is not just, you know, in the movies, you jump out of your helicopter and boom, they start shooting. No, you could be in, you know, on operation for a couple of days or even 4 hours. And when it hits, it's sudden. It's not expected.
Yes. But when you're out on an operation, when you're out on patrol and you know it's coming.
Well, sometimes you'll be doing administrative stuff on the battlefield, right?
Right.
You might be moving sandbags or something like that. Your mindset is not like looking, you know, you've got sandbag, well, you know, one of the, I don't know how you'd say in Hebrew, but one of the gunfights we had, we just, you know, moving sandbags from the APCs to some of them and right. Boom, it's on.
Right. You're busy doing something and it pops out of nowhere. But on the times that you were out there on patrol or, you know, you knew you were going into a hot situation, just mm-hmm. not when. What was your mindset?
It changes from the first time I was in combat. The first time I was shot at was everything was reactive. Everything was instinctive. There was nothing thought out. Just, you know, you do, I want to say you do what you're trained to do, but it's an automatic process. Everything just happens so quickly.
What That's I'm talking about.
Time. That's the first time. The other times after that are different.
Yes, I know.
After that are different.
And what I'm working towards is in Vietnam, there was a term which was you have to keep your shit wired tight. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now the idea of like wiring poop is kind of funny, but you know, when you realize you're dealing with a process predator. And you know he's here. Shifting up to here is necessary, but it doesn't have all the frou-frou. Rah, rah. You have one thing on your mind, and that is coming out ahead of this if it kicks off.
Okay.
Okay. Totally different mindset than a social violence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the difference between that and an actual military engagement is he has the ability to back away. Okay. He has the ability to decide if it's going to go or not. Mm-hmm. Okay. So either he's going to let you back away or he's going to back away. Okay. Or it's going to go down. Okay. That's not your choice. That's his. Okay. I mean, and the reason I say this in a civilian context, you know, you can't just shoot him up front. Oh, this is process predator. God, that's going to be a lot of paperwork. But you have to be ready for whatever decision he makes.
Yep.
Okay. And that is important. If you can meet him on this level, most of the time, he's going to choose not to go. Okay. Now, granted, this will leave you with tactical blue balls. Okay.
It's like, no, but it's, look, at the end of the day, I put the analogy. When I'm doing women's self-defense or in general, it's like, you know, the lion is looking for a predator that is going to be easy. And then I ask people, what's the lion looking for when they're looking? Sorry, when they're looking for prey, what's the lion? And people say, oh, you know, something easy. I say, okay, what does easy mean? Okay, for a lion, what does that mean? Oh, something that's. And I say, It means one thing. It means as little risk as possible. Yes, maybe putting out less energy. That's a secondary thing. But the main thing is as little risk as possible. And why is that? Of course, a lion can kill a zebra. That's a given. But all it takes is one, in a battle to the death, right?
Right.
The lion always wins. The lion always wins. The zebra never wins. But all the okay. Maybe if we're talking about giraffes, let's go. But
Because there's different ways of.
Okay, let me put my point and then tell me if you have a. Okay, let's avoid. Yes, I'm not a biology expert, and I maybe haven't seen my share of National Geographics. But here's my point.
Yes. Okay.
One time, the lion chooses the wrong zebra and gets a kick to the jaw and breaks the jaw. Well, a lion with a broken jaw can't eat, and a lion that can't eat dies. So the lion doesn't get to choose the wrong zebra more than once. And if they choose the wrong zebra, they die. So they're going to spend a lot of time watching and identifying and checking out to see whether there's a risk unless they're absolutely desperate. Okay. And the same thing goes to here. I can deter a process predator. I don't need to be stronger. I don't need to be bigger. I just need to make it clear that there's enough risk here as possible because they're not looking for a fight. Maybe they can beat me in a one-on-one cage match, right? Mm. But that's not what we're having here. We're not having a cage match here, and John McCartney isn't coming in, and nobody's getting a contract from Dana White, right? If I make enough noise and I scream and I shout and people see and they identify the process predator, that's it for them. Hopefully, if law enforcement and the justice system do their job, right? Which is a big if, but let's leave that one. Let's put that one aside. So they're not looking there for fighting. So if I can establish that there's enough that I'm a dangerous target, whether I can beat them or not, all things going right, they should be backing off. And if not, that's why I train in violence, so that I can put that into there too.
Yes to everything you said. And all right, I'm getting visited by a cat here. What you're talking about with the lion and zebra is known as a Pyrrhic victory.
Mm.
Okay. That is a victory that you win, but it costs you so much to win, you actually lose. Okay. Named after a guy named Pyrrhus who fought the Persians, came back, and I think it was the Romans. He won that battle, but it cost him so much, he came back and got his ass kicked.
I think it was between two kingdoms in the Greek islands. One tried to conquer the other. They managed to conquer it, but they lost so many soldiers that on the one hand, they couldn't hold any of the land that they won. And they also had almost no army left to defend their own place from other enemies.
So we beat him.
It's a victory that you win the match, but you lose the war.
Yes, and that is exactly, the cost of doing this. Now, the analogy I use is a wounded shark does not last long among other sharks.
Mm-hmm.
In a predatory environment, getting injured means you become prey. Okay, aside from, so even if they win, they lose. So that makes them very careful about target selection most of the time, unless you give them reason to go, which is, by the way, Peyton's 5+1 is a way that he's going to say, you know what, I got to do it. So that's why you don't want to do it. But the other thing is when you are playing at this level, okay, you talked about communicating to the person that it's going to be that way. Now, here's a serious problem with the way most people do it. They're trying to communicate it. Okay. They think it's a magic talisman that if I just do this, he's going to stop. So they focus on doing this without understanding what's underneath it. Okay, now, let me tell you a story. I hate paperwork. Loathe it. Okay, anytime I got into a violent incident, I had to do paperwork. Okay, when I was professional about this. So I tried to talk my own. I'm famous for my violence. What made me good at my job, though, was my ability to talk things down. So I was dealing with this guy, and he was being just, I don't know if there's a Yiddish word for this, but I mean, this guy was just not stopping. Everything I did, you know, didn't work, and I was getting more and more pissed. I'm trying to talk him down. And in my head, I remember consciously thinking, the paperwork's not worth it. The paperwork's not worth it, right? And he's like going off, and it's like, nope, nope, don't do it, don't do it. The paperwork's not worth it. Finally, it got to the point where I remember consciously thinking, you know what? The paperwork's worth it. Okay. And once I flipped that switch, okay, this guy's eyes got this big. It was like, hey, man, I'm sorry. I'll leave now. No problem. No problem. I'll be going now. Please don't hurt me. Okay. I had actually gotten into the mode where, you know, I was going to rip his throat out with my teeth. Okay. And kind of enjoy the process, too. Okay. Did I say anything? Oh, and by the way, when he backed away, it was like, come back. Come back. I want to kill you. Please. Don't leave me hanging. You tease. Right. That's what, you know, tactical blue balls. It's real. The thing about it was I didn't communicate that's what was about to happen. And I mean, I'm a madman when it comes to communicating. I am just communicating all the time. Right.
Well, if you could, like, I would argue, and maybe you'll agree, it's nonverbal communication, right? There is something that it's even unconscious communication. Something changed. He picked up.
Yeah, something did change.
You didn't say anything. You didn't try to assert anything. It was just you had a mind shift, and you say, okay, from a point of de-escalation, then you went to, okay, no, let's fight. And that is communication. Fight. There's something that was communicated. It was unconscious communication. And maybe that's where it's worthwhile putting over there. I agree with you. There's not, and that's why we come back. You can't fake these things, right? There's nothing, there's no set of words.
You're right. It's not faking, though. Somebody hits me, he is communicating that he is upset.
Mm-hmm.
Even physical violence can be a form of communication.
100%.
Right. But I actually wasn't communicating. I was leaking.
Mm.
My intent, I was waiting to go. Right. And it was like, make one more wrong move. Give me the excuse I need to rip your arm off and go Beowulf on your ass. Okay. It was just, I had shifted my intent and my body language changed and it was leaking from me that was my intent.
Yeah. And I love that. Right. It really connects to what we were talking about last time about, I think I gave the story of the guy with the phone, right? Of I've had so many encounters where things were de-escalated on the most part, it was because I was there. I was willing to go. I was looking at that person and I'm like, look, I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to be polite, but I'm just, you know, I know exactly where I'm landing. It's like I've got my finger on the trigger. I know exactly where I'm going to land my punch. And I'm just waiting for you to make that move. And when you're in that mindset, especially the bad guys and the people who are, you know, who've been around violence and conditioned around violence, they see that. And I've had like, again, in Sydney, a lot of these things happen in Sydney. Israel is, let's say the violence in Israel is more, you know, it's more terrorism and it's more around the military and stuff. It's like in Tel Aviv and stuff, in Sydney, they're very big on alcohol. In Israel, they're very big on pot, right? You walk past the bars in Tel Aviv and you just get high walking by. Yeah. So not a lot of fights happening over there. It's also, you know, a country that's predominantly Jewish. Jewish people aren't known as big drinkers and fighters. I think...
Right. Well, they don't fight each other. Yeah.
There's this comedian, Jackie Mason, I think. Maybe some of the older people will know him. He was a stand-up comedian. He was a rabbi. He had this joke about Italians and Jews, right? He says that, like, nobody goes, like, in a Jewish neighborhood and goes, ooh, let's be careful, you know, we're in a Jewish neighborhood, it's very dangerous here. And, you know, the Italians, especially, you know, quite a few years ago had a bit of a reputation. And he says that, you know, there's this opposite where, you know, you meet an Italian on the street and the toughest, you know, you want to go, you got a problem. Like, again, I'm going down stereotype and, the toughest person, but you put on a uniform, you put a uniform on them and they'll be waving the white flag, right? I'm sorry for my Italian friends. It's a joke based on World War II, but yeah, they don't have a reputation as a military, at least back then, of fighting. So they're the toughest guys you put on in a uniform and they don't want to fight. And the Jews, on the contrary, you know, you meet them out on the street, the last thing they want to do is fight, but you put a IDF uniform on Jews and, you know, they become one of the most, you know, toughest fighting forces.
Exactly.
So I don't know why. I don't know why I went down that realm, but it's the, it's this idea of being ready to go, and you can't you can't fake that.
And not just social fight. Remember, Italians are an honor culture.
Yes.
And that really does, you know, it is individual honor. You can look at the Jews as it's group survival.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think last time we talked about the switch between individual and group violence?
And no, we haven't. And that's what we need to, that's the next thing that I'd very much like to discuss. Okay. But I think that's really a very useful one. I was speaking with actually the Professor Bill von Hippel about honor cultures. And especially here in Israel, it's interesting because we're like, it's a Jewish country, which is generally more of a, less of an honor culture, more of a communal culture. As when we say honor in terms of violence, in terms of protecting your honor by using force. But we're also in the Middle East, right? And something people don't know, people think about Jews as European. In Israel, the majority of Jews living in Israel come from Middle Eastern and North African countries. The majority of Jewish people living in Israel are not of European diaspora, but they're actually in Muslim and African countries prior to 1948. So it's interesting because we've got a bit of both here. We've also got the communal side of it, but it's interesting because you're right, in the honor-based cultures, they'll be more likely to fight to protect their honor, to protect their family honor, but in the group settings, less so.
That's effect,
right?
That is a big, you know, honor cultures by and large do not have effective rule of law / government forces.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That, you know, I cannot rely on the police to do the job.
Yep.
Okay. Police will not come and take this bad person away. Honor cultures have to do it themselves. Okay. And if they don't do it themselves, they lose status.
Yeah.
Okay. And that makes it very difficult from people from rule of law cultures or dignity cultures is the common term, to understand when dealing with a person from an honor culture. It's like, no, you don't insult this guy because he will have to react. Otherwise, he loses social status.
Yeah. Well, it's a matter of survival. Like, if you think about Bedouin cultures, right? Nomadic cultures in the desert stuff. Generally, when the women are out, you know, with the flock outside, you need to know that nobody's going to attack your woman. And the way that you do that is by being a bad motherfucker, that if anybody as much as says a bad word on you, you cut out their tongue. So they definitely not going to get any ideas of doing anything with your woman or with your children or with your when you're not around.
There's because no police.
And if we if we put onto that, it's also, again, going down the culture, you can understand why in these more traditional cultures, there's area of what's like modesty up to the extent of, you know, that women cover them head to toe and put a burqa and stuff. If we put aside a religious perspective, it also makes sense because I want when the women are out in the field, I don't want them to be easily distinguishable. And I don't want them, you know, to be out there in a bikini so that people get ideas. It's all this kind of mixed together. Besides the religious aspect, it makes sense from a survival aspect. But if we live in a society where there's the rule of law, again, to make a jump, is talking about the Vikings that traditionally, the Swedes and the Norwegians, they're, you know, tough culture that go around raping and pillaging. And if you go nowadays, it's the same genetic material. It's the same people. You take a DNA test. Nothing has changed in their genes, in their brains, nothing. They're the exact same people, biology, but it's some of the most peaceful cultures there are. And Bill von Hippel, I'm going to steal from him. He said that, you know, if you go back a few hundred years ago, the person who'd be raping and pillaging and murdering, now they're probably the manager of IKEA, right? Because the culture has something to do with it. It rewards different activities.
Well, that is something that there's a really big shift towards race that bothers me because there's two camps. There's race and there's culture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm in the culture camp, which is if you look at it from the standpoint of culture, you can improve, you can solve problems, you can analyze why does this happen. You can work your way and say, hey, is there a better way of doing things? Okay, if it's about skin color, then it's fixed. We're done. Put a period. It's full stop.
Well, we've seen, if it's about race, we've seen where this goes. We've seen,
aware of that.
80 years ago, we've seen exactly when people are fixated on each other's race and separate people into groups. We know exactly where that leads.
Oh, wait a minute. Let's also remember something a little closer, which is the Balkans. Where, you know, you had this one overlord type power and everything was under control. Take that away. And all of a sudden, these guys were killing each other over shit that happened 500 years ago.
Mm.
You are not one of us. And I mean, just the whole genocidal or attempted genocide. So, yeah, race scares the hell out of me.
Mm.
Right. When you fix it that way and it's like nothing good can come of this. Culture we can work with.
100%.
Right. We can find a way. And, you know, now that actually does tie into multiple attackers, et cetera.
Okay.
Humans are weird. Okay. We are social primates. Okay. Now, when you think about bees in a collective, okay, you've got just these drones out there and there's really not much individuality in the drones or among the bees. Now you go higher up the food chain and you'll have pack animals that you will have individuals, but first and foremost, you have the pack. Humans as social primates are schizophrenic. Okay. We're very, very much individuals, but part of our brain and our wiring and is as a group and group identity. Okay. So the way I try and describe it is that there's a little switch inside of our heads, and it's not a, like, you know, from the Frankenstein movies where you have this big switch. It's a little electronic switch. It's very subtle, where we go from individual to group. Okay. Totally different mindsets. As a thinking individual, and oh, by the way, in dignity culture, they pride themselves on being individuals, and they look down on groupthink, right? Which is a really good example of, gee, groupthink, right? You're doing it right now, even as you're condemning it.
Yep.
Right? A big part of our identity is, yes, who we are. But an equally big thing of our identity is, what groups do we belong to? Okay. Take away either and you've got a basket case of a human being. Okay. The problem is when the switch gets thrown, we don't consciously recognize it. We fall into this way of thinking without realizing that's what we've done.
Yep.
And when you are dealing with multiples, when you are dealing with a group, you are not dealing with individuals. You're dealing with a group.
But there's something very intoxicated about it. It's by no coincidence that most religious worship is done in groups, right? We go and with groups, even chanting together, whether we're chanting in the church or the synagogue, or we're chanting at a protest, the same thing. It's funny because a lot of these things that we see in protests and violence, it's exactly the things that we see in our religious worship, because it's something that we're kind of programmed to do, and it's something that can really take you. I mean, if you've been there, I had a bit of an orthodox upbringing. As a kid, and you know, you're definitely there if you've ever been in a crowd of people like chanting religious prayers. There's something just spiritual that has the ability to transcend. On the one hand, there's something very, very spiritual about that. And I always say, if you go to the Western Wall in Jerusalem, it doesn't matter what you believe, and you just see people, it's gonna take you somewhere. Just being part of the crowd, something very primitive that takes over. Same thing by going to concert, right? What's the difference? Yes. Right? If you're listening to Jimi Hendrix, we all know, like, you can listen to Jimi Hendrix at home with your earphones with perfect sound quality, and you go to Woodstock and you hear, it's a completely different experience just being there in the crowd. Yeah. You're listening to the same music, but it's different. Oh. It's a different experience.
You use the word programmed, as in we are programmed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually going to argue that point by saying we are wired.
Okay, I'm
with then
you.
Hardware
rather than software. Hardware rather than software.
But that hardware affects the software.
Okay.
So, you know, you talked about the Wailing Wall, which is a mystical experience. Okay. And yes, it is. Right. Well, I mean, once you get there, if that's your culture, okay, it clicks to you on a level that is impossible to describe to somebody who isn't on that. Okay. I'm Scottish. I joke that, you know, my people invented the bagpipes as a weapon of war. Okay. And the thing is, when you hear the bagpipes, you know, almost in my genetic makeup, right? Bagpipes either make you want to weep or kill something.
Okay.
Okay. It's one of those things of like,
I'm a big fan. On a good AC/DC song
But George Lopez, a Mexican comedian, talked about Maharachi music. Okay.
Okay.
And he goes, you know, when you're young, come on, man, that's vacuuming music. That's the music mom put on while vacuuming the house. Right. And he goes, then you go out and you get a couple of beers in you and then you hear it. And it's like, and it's like, yes.
No, I can picture, who is it? Mad Jack Churchill, you know, marching into battle with his bagpipes or on Pegasus Bridge, the commandos who came in and stuff. It's definitely got its place.
It's weird because human beings have to be wired a certain way. Okay. The way you're raised in your culture kind of helps you, well, it determines which way it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Say, so it's again, you know, I would go to the Wailing Wall and I would feel something, I would recognize it, but it wouldn't have the same impact as it does for you.
Yep.
Okay. Same thing with hearing bagpipes coming over the hill.
Yep.
Right. Which I actually do have experience with that. And it's one of those, you know, the keening of the pipes over the hills in the morning. It's like,
you know. Yes. It strikes an emotional chord. It has it strikes you somewhere that you feel, but you can't describe.
Yeah. Deeper than emotion.
Yeah.
Whatever is below, I mean, like levels below. Well, the thing is, that's part of our group identity, right? Whatever group it is, we have different things. Okay. But like when I wrote my book on multiple attackers, the hardest thing to convey, and I say hard because I say this is, you know, this is the truth, and people go, yeah, I know that. It's like, no, I don't think you quite comprehend. When I say, when you are dealing with a group, do not treat it like you're dealing with an individual. Yeah, I said, I know that. No, you don't. you may consciously know it, but you do not grok it. Are you familiar with that term? Right? You understand it on such a deep level. It's part of your consciousness, right? Thank you, Robert A. Heinlein. But it's like when I say this is the most common mistake of dealing with a group is that you're thinking of you're dealing with an individual and you're basing your strategies on that rather than the basing the strategy on you're dealing with a group.
Okay, so let's for a second before we go any deeper. Let's maybe define. Can you give me a few examples of group violence that we'd be talking about, of multiple attackers? Can you give some scenarios? Like a few different ones.
Yeah. I have a story about that. I had a friend who lived up in the Sierra Mountains. And I was in California. And I went over to... I went up to his place, and this was before cell phones and GPS and all the tech, right? And he told me, look, go to this bar on this highway. Call me from there, and I'll come get you. Okay. Now, this is, you know, finding the way, you know, I'd follow him to his house, right? And, I mean, this is deep woods. So I walk into the bar and I look around and I mean, I'm talking, this is a place of flannel shirts and baseball hats. Okay. I should also point out very, very short hair. Now I had hair down to the bottom of my rib cage at the time. Okay. So I didn't belong in that bar. Okay. So I made the call and he goes, okay, I'll be there in a few minutes. So I sat down to have a beer. This guy started giving me shit, right? Goddamn hippie. What are you doing here, you hippie? You know, I didn't know this dude. Where I grew up, we handled things a certain way. So he started lipping off to me, and I dropped him like a prom dress. Okay? I mean, nothing. That sounds like a brag, but it really wasn't. It was just how we did business.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fuck with me and I'll drop you. Boom, 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 done. Right? The entire bar stood up. I'm sorry. I just remembered I have to go home and shampoo the cat. Bye. Boo. Right? And I mean, I ran fiercely. Okay. The thing about it was, I was an outsider to that group. And I didn't follow the rules of the environment, which was supposed to be, we punching back and forth and we're drinking some beers and, you know, or afterwards we're drinking some beer. Hey, you're a pretty good fighter. Oh, yeah, so are you. Damn, you know, I'm impressed, right? I didn't do that. I broke the rules. Oops. Okay. Now, I hauled ass down the highway. They chased me for a bit. They got, you know, they got tired and went back. My friend pulled into the bar and I'm hiding behind the dumpster. Right? It's like, psst, come here. Right? You know, what happened? Just go. I'll follow you. I jumped in my car and we left. That's an example of, I wasn't dealing with an individual when they all stood up. It was an entire group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are, okay, a lot of these movies will show, they'll establish the stud, you know, where this guy ends up fighting a bunch of guys. But it's like, if you insult somebody of a group, okay, it really is a true thing. If you go into a market in an ethnic community and you insult the store owner, okay, and somebody goes out that door and calls the neighborhood, all of a sudden they all come together to protect that store owner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter if they like him, they don't like him, they like it, it has nothing to do.
It's one of ours.
You've just, especially in honor cultures, you've just decided, yes. You've just dishonored the group.
Yes. And that's the same thing. It's like, if you want to get, you know, I've seen people actually go up to bikers, like 1% biker organization, you know, gangs, whatever word you want to call them, and think that they're only going to be fighting one biker when in fact you're fighting them all. And you're not going to be fighting. You're going to get beaten. Back at growing up, I got rousted by cops who I knew I could take. Right. But back then, under Daryl Gates, the LAPD was the biggest gang in the city. And if you messed with one, you messed with them all. The group honor, you know, that message, do not mess, had to be enforced and sent out. So these are examples. Pick one.
Yep.
You know, when you ask, what do I mean by this?
Would you call what we're seeing today with the Antifa BLM protests, you know, that's certainly in that category too, where a group just, you know, picks out an individual and that individual is going to have a pretty bad day.
Yes. And, but there's also, okay, it's called de-individualization.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is a weird thing because it's one of the switches, you know, the electronic switches in our heads. And it is when in a group, people will act out things that they would never do individually. Okay, they just flip that switch.
Yep.
And, you know, it's part of the group switch. Now, the weird thing about this is for some people, that switch can be with just, they're with one other person who is on their side.
Hmm.
Okay. And they are emboldened to act. Other people say it needs 10. Okay, some people, if and they're a group of, you know, 50 or 100, then they get bold enough to act. Some people will never flip that switch. But it varies with the individual as to where that switch will be flipped. And when you have a group of people willing to commit violence, the damage that they can cause is much greater than an individual. And they won't even think about it. Okay. They will be doing it, and partly because it's fun. Part of it is exciting. You know, Rory is very correct when he points out that the biggest bonding, motivation or the strongest bonds are made through committing violence with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It is. It's a very intense bonding experience. And it doesn't matter whether it's military, gangs, cops, or, you know, an ethnic community. Committing violence is, yes, we are. It is us versus them. And, you know, this mindset is so not understood in modern society. Okay. And it's a very big problem, because when you have people who are very, very accustomed to dealing with an individual, even individual violence, one-on-one violence, their skills, their training, and their experience goes that way. Okay. What works to intimidate one person in a one-on-one situation fails miserably when you're dealing with multiples, because the threat isn't there. So if I'm dealing with one-on-one, I go, I'm going to kick your ass. Right? That may intimidate an individual. But, you know, when these guys can count, hey, there's more of us than him. He ain't going to kick our buddy's ass. Right? So they bring more to the table than an individual can do using that level of force and threat.
Mm. I've also seen, especially recently, it's been quite a school with the quite an educational experience watching the BLM protests, where, you know, they'll come to somebody eating, you know, at a restaurant that's even maybe supportive of their cause, and they'll demand subjugation and a show of loyalty. And if that person doesn't do that, it's going to turn ugly very quickly. And often what we see in situations, people try to, you know, hold their ground or at least save face to some extent. And right. That generally, that doesn't always play out very well.
No, so
would you say that the way is, I don't know, like, is it humanization tactics? Does that work? Submission? What do you do when you have an angry mob that wants to kick your head in?
I'm a big fan of running.
Yes, I was going to say that, and you can't run.
I've actually, yeah, if even when it was my job, there were a few times that I was like, we're out of here. Whoop! But my job, like the last time, I actually was in a situation where I was facing like 50 guys. And even though I had a speed loader, I only had 5 shots.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the kind of people that if I shot their friend, they go, huh, and keep on coming. Right. So the mighty animal ran like hell. I got the people I was guarding out the door and down the road. Right. No hesitation. No, oh man, I should have done this. And anybody who tried to tell me, you know, oh, you should, I said, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Okay. But what do you do? What do you do when you can't run?
There's another story. I was a young lad at a party with a very specific social group, and these people were cool. They were mellow. I really liked hanging out with them because they were cool, because they were mellow. I mean, not the kind of people that I hung out with where violence was normal. So I was having a very good time, and there was a drunk chick who was there, and she, you know, working her way on being an alcoholic. There was a knock on the door. I answered the door, and it was a a bunch of guys from a different group, and they were trouble. Okay. And I'm like, it's like, hey, we hear there's a party here. And I'm like, no, not, you know, there's no party. I mean, there's a party going on behind me. And I'm like, no, no party here. Right. And they didn't know how to handle that. And we're going to get a cattail over. There you go. That's the non-obnoxious one, by the way. So the thing was, the alcoholic chick walks out and goes, hey, guys, come on in. Damn. Okay. So they came in kind of like, well, they went into the kitchen, grabbed some beers, and started making noise. Okay, and they began more. They were working their way up to causing trouble. Well, the hostess of the party went in and tried to reason with them. Okay, and it did not work. And, all right, come on, cat. So she's just losing ground more and more in front of these guys. Right. And I'm watching her. And it's like, you know what? That's it. I've had enough. There's nothing. So what I did is I walked over, grabbed a bottle by the neck, flipped it over, and I stepped up and I said, I'm looking for an honor guard into Valhalla, motherfuckers. Now, either you're going to mellow out or we're going to get real ugly. I doubt they knew what Valhalla meant, right? I doubt that they understood that in Norse mythology, the number of people you kill become your honor guard entering Valhalla after you've died. Okay. I think that kind of flew over their heads. But they did get the impression that I was going to do really serious damage before I went down. That despite their numbers, it was not going to turn out well for them. See, because the other thing about attacking in numbers is personal safety.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to get hurt. And all of a sudden they're like, yeah, with this guy I am. Now, again, that goes back to that was my intent. Right. That was backing up my words.
Yes. Okay. I'd say that this is, so again, these multiple attacker situations, there can be several different ones. And I would,
yes,
I would ask, okay, this is a case of, you know, of maybe social intergroup violence. Yes. I keep on picturing back in mind the riots that are happening. And this is now, they're fueled by rage. They have this rage against, you know, anti-fascist or God knows what about, you know, the injustice of the world. And they're looking for a victim that they could put all the rage on them and to bash. They're looking to, you know, something. And that's the one that I have really hard trouble envisioning how to de-escalate, because there's always that one asshole that's going to try to pull the group that way further. And the moment violence starts, or even a threat of violence, they're like, yes, now we can get the revenge on the world of all this rage that we have.
Okay, it doesn't make sense because you're only looking at half of the equation. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What you said, this is what you're talking about is known as self-soothing. Now, there's a difference. It used to mean in psychology that self-soothing was what you did to make yourself feel better. Okay. Well, they kind of divided that into two things where you now have self-care, or actually, let's call it self-care because this is better for you, where you do something that, you know, helps you deal, et cetera, et cetera. Self-soothing, it can be very destructive and especially destructive to you, but it's handling it a bad way. It's like going on a bender.
Mm-hmm.
Right? getting drunk, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there are certain people that I call them rageaholics, that they are so angry that the only way that they can function is to blow up periodically to let this pressure loose.
Yeah, they want to smash a shop, steal,
steal
shoes, whatever. It's about letting off the door pressure.
Okay, that's one side of the coin. Okay. The other side of the coin is it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
It is a rush. It is excitement. You get to do shit. You get in trouble, right? You get, oh, by the way, look at all this stuff.
Well, it's so also, okay, so in the group settings, what we lose is when we lose our individuality, we also lose our inhibitions, right? So yeah, nowadays, exactly. We have a drive for aggression. We have it just like we have a drive for sex.
Yes, yes.
Just like we have a drive for aggression. And part of that drive is a drive for violence. And all of a sudden, when our inhibitions, you know, same thing, like I'm in a concert, I could be dancing and screaming and shouting, and I'd never do that if I was just, you know, sitting with my friends in the room listening to music. But because I'm in a concert and everybody's doing it, all of my inhibitions go free. We can also talk about, you know, from a sexual perspective, you know, in cults and things like that, where, you know, in a group, people lose all inhibitions, ways that people wouldn't behave normally. And of course,
The group gives them permission, like in the cult. And I mean, I've seen sexual abuse in the cults. You know, it's like they are giving them permission to act this way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The group gives you permission, especially when you have a self-righteous cause.
Yeah. So now I want to break into the shop and steal. I mean, it's a rush. It's illegal. It's hurtful. Up. But if you put that aside, like, you know, just what power is it? Just I see a shop. I want that. I'm going to break the window and I'm going to take it.
Exactly.
That's power. That's power.
Yes, right there. Yes, it is a rush.
It's a rush, or, you know, just grabbing somebody and saying, you know, screw you. And, you know, because of you, the whole world is evil. And now we're all going to bash you.
Yes. And it's safe to act that way.
Mm.
Keep that in mind, because that is a critical component. I can get away with this.
Yes.
Okay. Now, when I walked into those guys, I mean, they were like pretty, hey, there's nobody here who can stand up to us. Oops, this guy ain't playing, right? Now, by the way, total side story, there was a very important lesson not about group violence from that incident. After I escorted the gentleman to the door, right, I turned and I was dating the hostess, and she ripped me a new asshole for interfering. She was handling, she was convinced, right? So, important lesson for young guys, do not intervene without asking first. Yeah. You want me to handle this? Right? Saves, you know, could have saved that relationship. But the thing is that they think they're invulnerable in a group. Okay. And again, this comes back to not communicating so much as leaking the fact, hi, that assumed safety you have. And now say, yeah, man, we're going to kill you. Right. Maybe. But not before. Well, it was in the movie Tombstone. Right. They may get me in a rush, but not before I make your head into a canoe. Okay, that was at an individual level. Okay, that's where people think, oh, I can handle it with, you know, if I can handle the individual, I can handle the group. No. But it's like, hi, I'm going to kill as many of you as possible before I go down. That takes the fun away. That takes away the safety. Okay, but that's if you can't do that. If you don't have it within you to go into that place, then either running or submitting is pretty much your only option.
Yep.
Okay. Now, sometimes they're not looking for submission. they are looking for to go through and maul as many people as they can. Okay. So that's when you have to be, you know, whoop, here we go. But it's amazing how many people will veer away from that mindset if they realize you're serious about going down fighting. You know, it's like, I have an, look, an opportunity for an honor guard into Valhalla. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I like that. It keeps on bringing, I mean, it's such a cliche, right? We say that the people who know how to fight rarely have to, but it's certainly the case that, you know, you can't, there's no shortcuts. You can't pretend.
No. That you're willing and to that, fight. Again, remember we were talking process predators?
In order to be willing to fight, you need to be, you need to have some, be comfortable with violence. And the best way to be comfortable with violence is to experience it in safe settings.
Any level of violence.
Yeah.
You have to be comfortable with whatever level. See, so again, the biggest surprise in my life was that I turned 21. I never expected to live that long. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I've always existed with knowledge of my mortality. Okay. I have also existed with the knowledge that this is not a safe world. Okay, so when dealing with a group, my attitude is, well, I may die, but I know how dangerous this is, and I know what my best chances of survival are. And that is to cause as much critical damage as possible before their will breaks, or to get their will to break. Now, even if it doesn't break, fine, you know, I may do enough damage that they can't attack me, or I'm going to go down fighting, and that's okay too.
Yep.
That will to operate at this level, and I mean, it's how many people can you kill or cripple in this amount of time? There's no punching, right? There's cutting throats, gutting people, slamming down. I mean, the carnage that you have to commit at this level to handle the equal threat of a group. See, you can't fight five guys, but you can rip a hole in them and run fiercely. Yep. Or you could take down three of them before they get you. Different mindset.
Yep. Yeah, and it's about that's combat. Mm-hmm. That's combat.
Yes, it is. See, and I mean, the thing about it is, you don't have to go there all the time. There are times for all these other levels, but it's like dealing with a process predator. Once you're facing these conditions, all that other stuff is off the table.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Terry Trahan made one of the most brilliant observations I have ever heard about this subject, and I could not put it into my book on multiple attackers. Okay. Because of the, oh, I know that. Or somebody will hear that and it's like, okay, that's what I need to do. It's like, no. Okay. You don't have what it takes to do that. But now that I've explained this level, okay, and this willingness, your last ditch effort to avoid having to go there, right? Terry summed up as when you're dealing with multiples, it's theater. Okay, you have to know how to perform. And I mean, that goes from leaking into actual performance to help them change their mind. Okay. To give them, maybe we should not bother this one. Okay. But without this level, without this ability, if you try and do theater, and that's why I say, you know, this communication, be careful about that. about, oh, how do I communicate? Right. It's actually not communicating that you're at this level. Anybody with half a sense can recognize it. The theater and communication you're doing is that they have an opportunity to leave. They still have a chance to be safe. Say, I have a saying, which is, I am negotiating until I pull the trigger. Mm-hmm. Okay. I am doing everything in my power to avoid having to go to violence. Okay. And, you know, at that level, it is, I'm literally trying to talk you out of making me have to kill you. Okay. I'm ready to kill you if I got it, but I prefer not to. So that's the communication, not this.
Yep.
This is leaking out. This is what is telling him we don't have to die.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think on that optimistic note.
Yes. So, yeah, on that optimism, we should wrap it up.
Yeah, I think the 2 hours just went flying by. I've still got quite a few things I'd like to ask you about fear management versus danger management. We haven't even gone into home invasions. So there's a few things to talk about. I suspect we'll be talking.
I hate saying this. I am really going to hate saying this. We can cover it next time.
I think that's what we're going to do. So I'm going to stop the recording right here, and we will talk again.
Okay, good.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you're feeling especially generous, leave me a rating and a review. The full episode notes are available on ronengelman.com, where you'll find links to what we discussed today and information on how you can train with me and my team in Israel. Stay safe, stay healthy, please stay well, and I'll see you around.